My name is Michael Pellet, and I'm a Lutheran pastor in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and I also teach in the philosophy department at the University of Saskatchewan. And this week, in fitting with the theme, the many-colored grace of God, I'm looking at different ways within the history of our tradition that theologians have tried to articulate that experience of grace and how grace is at work, saving us, empowering us, working for the love of God and love of neighbor. And we've looked at how that happens in theologies of liberation. We've looked at that sense of grace both in the Hebrew and the Christian scriptures. Yesterday we looked at grace from the perspective of Augustine, and today we're going to look at it from the perspective of Thomas Aquinas, certainly the greatest medieval theologian, and there you see his dates. The other thing you'll note that between basically the death of Augustine and the birth of Thomas is 800 years, so you can see we're doing a thorough analysis of grace because we skipped 800 years. But they're not important because they're called the Dark Ages. Nothing happened anyway, so let's move right on. No, there's lots of things going on there, but we're just not going to be there. Okay, the great thing about Thomas is also known as the great synthesizer, because his basic understanding is that if God is one, then truth must be one, united. And therefore, there can be no conflict or contradiction between reason and revelation, between nature and grace, between the book of nature, if you will, that we read around us, and the book of grace, which would be the scriptures. And so much of what, or if you will, all of Thomas's basic work and understanding is simply to show that there is no contradiction between reason and faith, nature and grace. All of it is one. And that he called, what he was doing was scientia divina, the divine science. And of course here in Latin, science simply means knowledge. So that divine knowledge of doing this great synthesis is what he's about. That's what his Summa Theologiae is all about. And of course, in that he spends a lot of time talking about grace. But he does that in a very abstract and conceptual way. That's why I said our friend Thomas is going to be brain cracking and brain crunching, because this is heavy philosophical, theological, conceptual kind of talk. More so then certainly we would get within the biblical understanding or with Augustine or certainly with Luther. So when it comes to grace, Thomas then is going to distinguish, what he's going to work with are two basic understandings of grace. Again, just to give you his specific terminology, gratuita de voluntas, the gracious will of God, that's grace in itself. It's the sense God is gracious. Right? So the very being of God, the very doing of God, who God is and what God does is grace. So in other words, you know, Thomas is going to say, well, we got to figure out how God's going to do a little grace on. Right. How that happens is what he calls donum gratuitum, the gracious gift of that will. So that my way of saying that is that's talking about grace for us. So Thomas is going to think about grace in itself, very conceptual, and then think about how that grace in itself, as it comes to us, is experienced by us and is for us. Those are the two key things Thomas is going to talk about. And what he also does as the great synthesizer is that, of course, the truth of theology and the truth of philosophy or reason cannot contradict one another. So much or most of Thomas's task here in this divine science is he's going to take the philosophy of Aristotle, which was again revived in the Latin West after the Crusades, and Thomas's teacher, Albert the Great, is the one who really brings Aristotle into Western thinking, and Thomas has as many commentaries on the works of Aristotle as he does theological stuff. So, right, he did both Aristotle and theology. And so he's going to take the philosophy or the reason of Aristotle and synthesize it with the theology of Augustine. So it's those two things that are going to meld and come together. And so if you were in the session yesterday, of course you know everything there is to know about Augustine, so that half of the equation is already solved. So all we have to do is how are we going to get Aristotle and Augustine synthesized to work together? All right. How do we do that? Well, Thomas, like Augustine, like philosophy in the West since the pre-Socratics, still have this hierarchy of being, or this great chain of being that I talked about yesterday. And of course, God is at the top, the highest good, all truth, all wisdom, all knowledge, and so on and so forth. Then there are the spiritual beings, angels, whatever you want. Humans, and here again we have to be a little more specific, because humans have both soul and body, and the soul is comprised, according to Augustine, of reason, will, and desire. Then we have animals, plants, matter, nothing. Because again, for Augustine, as he looks at Genesis 1, the earth is without form and void, right? Chaos. So God creates out of nothing. So God, the highest good, starts with nothing, and we get all this stuff in between. Right? And now here's where we get a significant distinction between Thomas and Augustine. Augustine is going to say, grace enters into all of this, as we learned yesterday, with Christ, who comes because our will is curved in upon itself, and God and the grace of Christ are going to straighten that out for us again. What's lost in the fall is faith. What is graciously returned and given to us again through the work of Christ is faith. That's not Thomas. Here's where he differs. If you will, to use fancy language again, his understanding is not Christological. It's not tied to Christ, but it is tied to creation. That Thomas's understanding is that creation itself is the way in which, is the medium in which God places all grace into the world and into us, such that the capacity for being gracious is always already there in the gracious act of creation. And we'll see that with human beings, that gracious act of creating a human is not complete until Christ. So if all of you thought that on the sixth day when God creates humans, you know, we're all done with humanity, wrong. It takes God to finish the full creation of humans with Christ. And that's what makes humans truly human. But you can see then how grace is going to be understood from that whole creation side of things. A little bit of Thomas for you here. This is from his small monograph, De Veritate, on truth. And he says, quote, "If we were to speak of God's grace not as some habitual gift," and I'll explain habit in a little bit, "but as God's very mercy itself, by which God works from within the movements of the mind and ordains external affairs to one's salvation. In this sense, one cannot perform any good work without God's grace." That's just like what Augustine said. But one more sentence. "But in the mode of speech common today, people use the word grace for a habitual, justifying gift." So in other words, again, what he's saying is grace is either uncreated, God's very own self as the gracious giver, and that's where he's got, that's this portion here, and this is totally, completely, fully Augustine. You can find places there where he just lifts stuff right out of Augustine. Doesn't even footnote it. Or, right, the second one here, which we're going to look at more closely, is a created gift superadded to natural human powers, rendering their acts meritorious. Now, how does that work? Again, quoting from Thomas, this is his Summa Theologia, his big work, and a little part of that, key things on his notions of nature and grace, and this is the text I'm working from here, Aquinas on Nature and Grace. There is a copy of this in the Holden Library, believe it or not, and I'm sure after class you'll all be rushing out because you couldn't wait to read this. Anyway, that's from now on, all the quotations that I'll read from Thomas are taken from his sections here on nature and grace. Here's one of the things he says. "Persons obtain this grace through the Son of God made man. Grace first filled his humanity and thence was brought to us. Thus it was fitting that grace which overflows from the Word incarnate should be carried to us by perceptible external realities, and that perceptible external works should be brought forth from this inner grace by which flesh is subjected to spirit." In other words, here again you see with the completion of humans in Christ, Christ had so much grace, so much of this inner grace of God at work in him, that it just simply spilled, overflowed. The word there literally means like when a river overflows its banks, right? It floods out. And of course, that flooding out of grace is, that's the grace that's there for us to get. Now the danger with this, and we'll get to this, it's not in Thomas himself, but it's what happens with later folks who interpret Thomas, like Gabriel Biel, who is the Thomistic theologian that Luther read, or Cardinal Cajetan, who is the papal legate and the chief theological opponent to Luther in these understandings. They took this notion of the gratuitous gift, they saw that gift, I'll use a highly technical term, stuff. Right? In other words, again, and you can see this in some popular pietistic Catholic practices of the sacraments, right? The sacraments is stuff. So that, you know, why do you go to the Eucharist every week? Because, you know, that week you live and you sin and all of that, and there's some problems there, and so what? You need some stuff. A little grace, a little body and blood of Christ. And I'm not trying to be facetious here. I'm actually being serious, right? A little body and blood of Christ that will, right, provide remission for those sins so that you can then go on and live a meritorious life for the next week. And all the sacraments provide some stuff. Baptism is the stuff that can get rid of original sin. And then the other sacraments are the things needed to carry you life through life. First and foremost, the Lord's Supper. But you're also going to have the other sacraments of ordination and last rites and marriage and all the seven sacraments within the Roman Catholic understanding of sacrament. But that's what happens here, see? And this, of course, this is a problem that Luther and Calvin and many other theologians pointed to say, you know, they really have no problems whatsoever with what Thomas and interpreters of Thomas say in terms of the gracious will of God. In fact, they think most of that stuff is right on and very good. But it's when this second understanding of grace and the grace for us becomes stuff, it's problematic, and it also becomes, and I'll give you a little foreshadowing there, semi-Pelagian. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not crass Pelagian like we had yesterday in those seven theses, but it's a little bit, it's the kind of stuff called a kind of cooperative understanding of salvation, right? Salvation means God does God's part, but it's not only God, or again, right, Luther language, grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone, but it's also, we've got to do our part. And so it's that kind of cooperative, or sometimes called syncretistic, right, putting those two things together, that again, Luther and other theologians will see as problematic, and we'll talk about that as we come to the end of it. But okay, so there's our general understanding of how grace works. Again, Thomas here. Grace moves us beyond our natural powers, certainly beyond our sinful, wounded powers, elevating us to our transcendent end. An end here means goal, aim, the telos, right? Where we're going. In other words, our end is to be with God. Augustine, right? Our heart is restless until it finds its rest in thee. It's this rest, or Thomas would call it the beatific vision, and sometimes he calls it divinization, from the Eastern way of talking about that. And divinization here does not mean that we become God, but to be divinized means that we are fully, totally incorporated or participating in the life of the Trinity. That's kind of mystical, isn't it? And of course, the other thing, perhaps ironic, is that Thomas is also a mystic. Right? So he's, right, tremendously rational and heady, and yet with this notion of beatific vision and divinization, when he talks about that, he incorporates and uses all the mystical language of medieval mystics. So, you know, and of course you could say, why not? Because if truth is all one, we ought to be able to use nature, reason, theology, philosophy, and mysticism, and it'll, you know, it all says finally the same truthful thing. And so, again, in that sense, right, Thomas practices what he preaches. To continue on to the, with this sense of elevation, and again here, you see what we do is it takes our soul, reason, will, desire, and we are elevated, right? This is our end, our goal, our rest. This is the elevation, right? Drawing us up to God. Again, Thomas, quote, God has ordered humans to a goal that transcends their natural powers. Only by reason of a further gift, the aid of grace, can one merit or deserve the attainment of the goal and its transcendent fulfillment. Any free act under grace proceeds both from human choice and from the grace of the Spirit, moving and empowering human freedom. Only as moved by the Spirit is an act meritorious. All right. How are we going to figure all that out? This way. Again, this is Augustine's understanding of things, and Thomas thinks that's okay, but he thinks we need to articulate that or understand it a little differently. This is the human being, by the way. Comprised of caro and spiritus, you look at those two first. Caro is the word for flesh, right? Think about, you know, like incarnation or chili con carne, as opposed to chili con Bino. All right. I shouldn't. I'm just curved in on myself. All right. Caro. Caro entails what are called, again, philosophically, the appetites and the senses. This is the world of desire. This is our body. We're hungry, we're thirsty, we're tired. All of those kinds of things. Spiritus is our reason and our will. Our intellect and moving our intellect into action. When we get to think about this theologically, reason and intellect, Thomas says, will be the realm of faith. Will be the realm of love. Right? Putting faith into action. Now, right, if you will, that's everything there is that Augustine had. And this is where Thomas comes along and says, but there's one thing missing in terms of the human being. This up here, and he calls this justitia originalis, or if you will, original righteousness. And he picks this up from Augustine, but the inverse. Remember, we ended up in the Pelagian controversy in order to provide the rebuttal and answer some of Pelagius's and Celestius's criticisms of his theology. Augustine said, well, the way in which I can explain that is, or I can explain it, but I can't spell it. Original sin. But of course, now Thomas thinks about that and says, yeah, but you know, original sin is the fall and after the fall. So that must have meant that before the fall, there had to be, we were created with what? Original righteousness. This is, this original righteousness is again the graced and particularly gifted part of creation. He called this original righteousness a donum super additum.
Sure.
A super added gift. Right, it's the kind of thing that why would you put just regular octane in your car when you can go high octane? Right, you get the super additive in there, the super added gift. And what that super added gift does is it provides the human with the capacity to balance the body and soul, the senses, the reason, and the will. In other words, right, the problem here, as we know from Augustine, is the will can be divided. The will can be weak. It can be powerless. And as in sin, Thomas would agree. And we certainly know, again, I'll use another real theological term here, our appetites and senses can get real uppity and very hard to control, and even more so, they're going to start battling one another. Right. One desire says, right, I want a party, I want a party, I want a party. Another desire says, I want to sleep, I want to sleep, I want to sleep. And you know, they're going to be fighting one another. So how can you control your appetites and your senses? How can you have enough willpower to hold it all together? Well, you've got that super added gift, which coming into your spirit side, your reason and will, enables you to keep it together in a perfectly balanced, harmonious way. Okay? So everything should be good. And it was. Until Genesis 3. When Adam and Eve come along and say, thank you very much, God, but you know, we can do it on our own. We don't need your super added gift. And so they reject it. Of course, that means original righteousness is lost, and now we're in the condition of original sin. And that means what? This all falls apart. And again, you can see, in many respects, Thomas is a very good reader of the scriptures, because if you read Genesis 2 and 3 together, right, you start at Genesis 2, verse 7. And again, here in the second creation account, remember, humans are made first, and the human, Adam, comes with, right, God's breath of life and out of the dust. And they're joined together, and then from there, right, you get the garden here, and then the animals and all of that, and then you get the woman, and you end up right there in the very center, the heart and center of it all is that what?
That was good.
Now, good is the first account. Well, how you know everything is just perfect in the second account of creation is what? We're naked.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's the symbol of innocence, right? Take a 6-month-old infant, strip them, have them climb, crawl around here on the floor. They couldn't be happier, not a problem. Any one of you want to volunteer? Yep, something happened. And then, of course, note, once they know they're naked, now all of this stuff that was brought together where you can control yourself in harmony. So this part of creation is all talking about harmony. Now we get to discord, right? The first sense of discord, I love that this is great Hebrew humor, right? They sew fig leaf loincloths. And if you know fig leaves, right, fig leaves have a very brusque, harsh consistency. The closest thing I can think of is like Velcro. So if you write the contemporary story, you say, they sewed for themselves Velcro underwear. Right? You know, so if you want to understand how sin is irritating, wear a Velcro thong for it. Woohoo! Right, that's discord, that's irritation. Then, of course, there's irritation between the man and the woman, right? The woman you gave me, it's her fault, and the snake, her... I mean, the only one who's willing to fess up in the story is the snake, right? And the discord until, at the end, right, remember that you were dust, and to dust you will return, right? The breath of life will leave you, and we're right back here in this total disjunction as we were here in 2 steps. So it all falls apart. That's Thomas's interpretation, right? We come with original righteousness, and that's how it ends up in that innocence and fully reliant grace of God to hold it all together, and now it all falls apart. So there we go. And therefore, yes, original sin. And how does original sin affect us? It affects all three parts of reason, will, and desire. Original sin now means there is ignorance with regard to the intellect or faith. We do not know God. Know in the sense of both intellectual and that Hebrew sense of knowing someone, a relationship with God. With regard to the will, there is now, instead of love, there is malice. As seen, of course, this whole disjunction doesn't end. Genesis 3 is bad enough, but then we can go to Genesis 4, Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel. For Thomas, that ought to show a little malice in the will, huh? I mean, can't get more malicious than murder. And the thing with regard to desires is the notion of concupiscence. And concupiscence, again, is Thomas's way of saying how we are turned in on ourselves, right? Hupere is desiring, and so we always want to desire together, desire our own self, our own things, which will always be an inclination away from God. So there you go. Ignorance, malice, desire for anything else other than God. So we're in a mess. So, given that situation, we're now going to have to ask ourselves, according to Thomas, some questions. Because we're now in this situation of sin. So, can a human person do any good at all by reason of her or his own natural powers? Class?
No.
No, can't do any good at all. We are worms. On a good day. Yes?
How close is Augustine's concept of original sin to the later Protestant theology of total depravity? Is it pretty much the same?
It's pretty much the same. But again, total depravity, which is a term that Luther uses it once or twice. Calvin really picks up on it. He likes it. But again, it's often been misunderstood, right? It doesn't mean, you know, stark, lunatic, raving, wretched, good. What it means is that given the fact that we have lost this original righteousness, right, that we are deprived, depravity really means like privation or deprived. Given that we're deprived, then that means in our totality, and here Thomas would say that, right, our totality of reason, will, appetites, or desires are all encapsulated in sin. Right, so that means again, right, ignorance, malice, concupiscence. But can we do any good? Yes, we can. Again, Thomas is going to make a distinction. We can do good acts with regard to some of the interrelationships between our spirit and our flesh. In other words, right, he uses examples, we can build a house. That's a good thing. You need a house for shelter. Or we can plant a garden because we need food and all of that. What we cannot do are any meritorious good acts. In other words, we cannot do anything that will merit or elevate us toward rest with God. So in other words, in that sense, socially, politically, ethically, we can still be good.
Does man have any conscience in the schematic?
Yes. Conscience is pretty much linked with ethics and the will, and so you can do some good things. But it's going to be very hard to hold it together because, you know, after all, I can do some good things and I can get along with my brother for a while, but then after so and so long and his sacrifice goes up and mine doesn't, I just kill him. So it means there's also times when I don't do, right? I mean, in other words, my will can do some good things, but there's always, because I don't have this grace anymore, there's always the possibility and the reality that I'll act maliciously. There's a hand. Yes, please.
So he could not imagine a situation even when one person decides to save another's life by sacrificing their own that still wouldn't elevate itself to a level of merit. Or did he believe that people just couldn't do that on their own?
On your own, the whole meritorious side to elevate you, without this grace, you can't do it. So again, to sacrifice your life for someone else, very noble. You were able to exercise your will that time in a very self-sacrificing, loving way. Good for you. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what he would say.
Yes. Are we able to love without grace? I thought that love came from grace and without. Yeah.
Well, again, what kind of love are you talking about? Love of God? No. Love for someone else, let's say love of desire, okay. In terms of desire, sure. Even a higher love, friendship, yes. Love your wife, yes. or spouse. But there's also the time, too, when, you know, your will is going to be malicious and, right? You know, you'll say, like Henny Youngman, take my wife, please, right? Mm-hmm. I don't do the comedy sessions as much. Right? That's going to be there, too. So it's always that will, reason, desires is going to struggle. We can't keep it together. But it doesn't mean it's totally out, because if that would be the case, it would mean that we would have lost our reason, our will, and our desire when sin happened. And right, that's not the case, right? Experientially, we do reason, will, and desire. All right, second question. Can one, by reason of one's own natural capacities, avoid sin? No, someone said.
No.
No? How many say no? How many say yes?
If you can do it temporarily.
How many say maybe?
The stuff of sin or the state of sin?
The stuff of sin. The state of sin, if you will. We're all in that because right, we've lost this. So, but can we avoid sin?
Michael, is that where the distinction between mortal and venial sins comes in?
Yes.
What?
The venial being sin that happens sort of sub original righteousness, but not against God.
So it's the notion, again, Latin's kind of fun here, right? The mortal sin is the peccatum, and the venial sin are just your little peccadilloes. No, that's Latin, come on. Right? I mean, that one's carried over, right? You know, so little white lies, right, are venial sins, are peccadilloes. It's like, oh, that shirt really looks good on. All right, so the answer to this is maybe, but not for long, as you've said back there. It's the whole sense that without that grace, we cannot avoid serious sin for long. In other words, we might be able to summon up enough reason and willpower to fend off sin once. But we're not going to be able to do that our whole life and everything like that. So you might get lucky once or twice, but it's not going to work. So it's basically maybe a little bit, but finally, no. 3, can a person fulfill the precepts of the law solely by drawing on his or her own faculty? And here, law again, we think about 10 commandments and all that kind of stuff. Can we fulfill the precepts of the law by drawing on our own faculties?
Yes.
Yes? How many say yes?
Temporarily.
How many say no? How many say maybe? All 3 answers are wrong. So
oh, no.
It's a trick.
I know. Trick question. Thomas says, well, it depends on what you mean by law. And what he...
Said that.
Huh? Here is that you could fulfill the precepts of the law in terms of the letter of the law. So we'll pick the 5th commandment because that's the easiest one and comes up again in the Sermon on the Mount, and Thomas uses that there too, right? So, right, if the commandment, if the letter of the law is don't murder, I'm hoping all of you who have upheld that commandment, right? You haven't murdered anyone.
Yeah. 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 Thought about it really, really seriously.
I know, and you're looking at me and I'm getting worried. The spirit of the law is such that, again, think Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, right? You've heard it said, don't murder, but I say to you, if you call a brother or a sister fool or idiot,
right,
it's like doing that. Right. So in other words, can we fulfill the letter of the law? Yes. Can we fulfill the spirit of the law? No. And so therefore, we all end up condemned, right? Because again, in order to fulfill that spirit, to elevate us to God, we're going to have to use God's grace. Question 4. Can one prepare for the reception of grace by drawing solely on one's natural resources? In other words, we've lost this grace. We want to get it back. Is there something we can do to help get that back? Or is it beyond our own human resources, capacities of reason, will, and desire to get that grace back?
Clarification, you're saying, is there something we can do? And the question says, drawing solely, would there, is there this,
no, I want to keep it this way. Can we prepare for reception by drawing solely on our natural resource? In other words, right, it's not that we're going to do all the grace ourselves, but by drawing on our resources, can we engage in some preparation? Solely on our resources, can we do something?
No.
No. I may say no. I may say yes. Here's Thomas. A certain preparation of the person for grace is simultaneous with the infusion of grace itself. God does not withhold grace from one who does his or her best. A difference from Augustine. Augustine was, I'll do the Latin because he does this little word play, curvatus in se est, curved in on the self. And when you're curved in on the self, then you couldn't draw on your resources to do anything. Facerende in se est is Thomas. This is, right, to do what is in you. In other words, this is where we get into the you do your part, right? You do what is in you, and then God does what God. So in other words, the thing here is, yes, you can prepare for grace, but you can't do it like, I'll prepare, and then God comes. It's, for Thomas, it's simultaneously. Both have to happen. Because if that is not the case, right, then it would mean that, right, it is not the movement of God or of us, right, and God working in us.
think I left that quotation out, right? All right, so that's how things are going to work. Or again here, God will not deny grace to the one who does what he or she can as moved by God to do this. The good movement of free will by which one is prepared to receive the gift of grace is an act of free will moved by God. And so therefore, now when we're talking about receiving this grace and how we get this grace back again to keep ourselves together or put ourselves back together, here we have the four moments in the process of justification, right, in terms of how we will be able to be elevated to rest. First, there is the infusion of grace, just like Augustine had, right? God's grace, that grace of God infused, comes to us. Then there is the free movement of the will, which is what we're doing simultaneously there, in faith toward God. So that's the move up. Third, then, there is also the free movement of the will against sin, right? So in other words, it's the same thing, right? As you, if you will, move toward God, you are moving away from, against sin. And when that happens, there we have the remission of sin. Okay? We're all right with that? So where that takes us then, seeing this guy gets complicated, is to four categories of grace. There is actual operative grace. And that is inclining the will to desire the telos, the beatific vision, the good or rest, and operating without need of response. This is all God's part, the operative grace, such that it will move us toward rest, right? This would be Augustine's, our heart is restless until it finds its rest in thee. But then there is actual cooperative grace. That is assisting the renewed will to realize its good intentions in a choice of means and external actions, all requiring the will's cooperation. Right? That's what you can do for love of neighbor and even for things in terms of praise of God, and so on and so forth. This is the kind of grace, as I said in the little shtick here, that you're going to find in most of your Bible camp songs. Right? P1, right? Give me gas in my Ford, keep me trucking forward. Right? Right, that? Cooperative grace so I can keep trucking. Or one that may not be as well known to you but has the same thing. Great song, we ought to sing it in Vespers some night. Drop kick me Jesus for your glorious. Anybody know that? Oh, right? That's And you think about, you know, again, if you look at the words, and, you know, I guess when you think theologically, Bible camp songs just drive you nuts. And you kind of hope your kids just like to sing them and you never, ever think about the words. Anyway. You see, it is this Thomistic understanding that has You know, it's alive and well today, and that's fine and all. But what I mean is, again, you think, wow, highfalutin Thomistic theology, you know, Karl Rahner, Hans Kung, all of those guys are Thomists. And then Bible camp songs. Same theology there. A little watered down, perhaps. All right. So those are two of the four. Then, third one is habitual operative grace as the formal principle of justification. Okay, here we go. Habitual. Habit. Habitus in Latin. And habitus, you can think about habit. Probably the best English translation of it is the notion of disposition. Right. Everyone you know has a certain disposition, right? You know, your disposition or your friend's disposition is that, you know, they're just always honest. Right? They couldn't lie if they wanted to. That's their disposition. Or, you know, it can be humor. The habitus here is your disposition, and what habitual operative grace does is that's the formal principle. And again, form, it comes out of Aristotle. Everything is comprised of form and matter. Matter is the stuff of which it is. The form is its structure. So that the habitual operative grace is the formal principle of justification. In other words, it is God's grace at work in us that is going to give us that disposition to be inclined toward God. So that's the grace that is going to combat our dispositions of ignorance, malice, and concupiscence. And ignorance, malice, and concupiscence will be replaced by the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love. And so that will be our disposition now. With God's grace, we're going to be disposed to act toward God and one another in terms of faith, hope, and love. And then habitual cooperative grace is grace as the principle of meritorious deeds for sanctification. So that for Thomas, justification is that vertical relationship with God. Sanctification is the horizontal relationship with neighbor and world. And that's, again, always in terms of meritorious deeds. So in other words, they're meritorious because now these deeds, moved by grace, are such that they merit, they too can elevate. And, of course, if you go overboard and emphasize only habitual cooperative grace, then you are in the situation of salvation by good works, which again is an aberration of Thomas's theology, but it is the kind of way that someone like Gabriel Biel, again, who is one of the leading Thomistic thinkers of Luther's time, understands it. So you can see why Luther and the other confessors and reformers at the time are always harping against justification by works. Because Biel and company went overboard by that. And of course, right, it didn't help that the Pope, to get a few bucks for St. Peter's, comes up with a notion of indulgences where it basically says, you know, well, if you don't have enough good works to elevate, you don't worry. There's extra credit around. All you have to do is buy it. So you can see, right? Luther's not a happy little German. because in that sense, it truncates Thomas's genuine theology by basically saying, we're only going to concentrate on this fourth aspect of grace, and the other three, well, there's no money in them, so forget it. Right? No, that's how crass it became in some situations. And that's, right, sets the part for the Reformation. All right, one more thing. To again show the combination with Augustine and what follows. Right? We have a restless heart. What would that mean for Thomas? Well, that is our natural desire for happiness and fulfillment. Right, bracketed there, it's that sense of God, even though we as right natural fallen human beings don't know it. But it, the restless heart is there, right, whenever a parent says, I don't care what my child does, I just want them to be happy. And for all of us, right, isn't our goal in life to achieve happiness and fulfillment? Right. Nothing wrong with that, but that shows our restlessness. In terms of what? We haven't achieved that happiness and fulfillment yet, and so we're going to spend our whole lives doing it and failing, because that can only happen with God's grace. And so therefore, the heart at rest is desire for God evoked by grace, to love God above all and in all. And this is a phrase from Thomas. It is participation in the life of the triune God. That's what the divinization here is all about. So again, of course, right, true happiness, rest, cannot be achieved without this fourfold understanding of God's grace at work, the grace which is bestowed upon us by God in virtue of creation itself. And there we are. Time's up, but I'll be happy to try to answer questions, or if you have some comments, reactions to this. I know, I warned you, it's brain crunching, lots of stuff here, but, you know, what you think about it or whatever, I'd be happy to try. But of course, you can all go. That's, yes, please. Yeah.
Did Thomas ever deal with Book of James?
Yes, yeah, he has commentaries on every book of the New Testament. I mean, the other interesting thing is that, you know, here in 1274, Thomas becomes ill. He has what was, you know, I guess what we call now a nervous breakdown or everything. And one of the last things he wrote was a little, with just a little sentence that says, everything I have written is straw.
So where did he come out on the works faith thing as it discussed in James?
He would understand that as number four. James is talking about number four. Right? That there is the habitual cooperative grace in order for us to do meritorious deeds. So he would say James is an illustration of four. Where, of course, most of the Pauline stuff, let's say like in Romans, would be illustrations of one and three. Scott, you're
good. I once read an article by George Lindbeck in which he suggesting that the kind of basis for lots of kind of discord between Catholic and Lutheran theologies is that what Luther means by faith is what Thomas means by hope, and that they what Luther uses the word faith, he's not using it in the same way that Thomas does, but that the correspondence is between faith and Lutheran hope and Aquinas.
Yeah, I know we had those arguments with Lindbeck years ago on some of that. And in some cases, I think Lindbeck is right, but I think there are other places where
where Thomas on faith and Luther on faith, if you will, butt up against one another. But it's, again, like I said, really hard to do. I mean, Luther scholars, there's the big debate. Did Luther ever read Thomas Aquinas? No one has come up with a definitive answer. You know, we're all sure he read Beale, he read Cajetan, he read Eck. But all of those folks kind of warped Thomas. And so, there's again the issue in terms of, okay, well, you know, certainly Beale's notion of faith that he thought was in Thomas and Luther reading Beale, yeah, wrong. Right? They really butt up. But I think there's other places where Thomas and Luther on the issue of faith itself will part company. But yeah, it's a good question, and it's also a very complicated one. You are free to go. I don't want to chain you.
So Christ, as Thomas Aquinas understood it, he was just the vessel for this grace, and grace is what?
Yep, because again, Christ is that firstborn creation and all of that, in whom all this grace that was lost comes back, and he's got so much of it, right? It overflows that it's going to all be there for us as well. But it was there already by virtue of creation. So in other words, God, the sense, and we still, I mean, you know, other theologians will say this too, right? God creates redemptively, and God redeems creatively. You hold those two together. You can't split them off.
So, well, that's when you were, that whole idea of infusion you were talking about, that's where I got just a little lost, because I thought that was something coming in, but you had said it was already there, and so I...
Yeah, it's already there because it was there at creation itself. It's lost, so it has to come in again, but you see, it's not doing anything new. But it's again replenishing what had been lost, and so how is that infused? How does that come to us? Primarily through the sacraments. Because after all, that's where that grace of Christ, right, that overflowing, abundant grace, that's where it now, right, when Christ says, "This is my body, this is my blood," to participate in the Eucharist is receiving the grace of God, the grace of Christ.
So it's not like a door opening that we've closed inside, it's actually, it actually leaves and...
Yeah, you know, it's not a door that's closed, because remember, this was lost, it's gone,
it
needs to be replaced. It has to come back. That's why the fourth moment of justification, right, is remission. Not, you know, which is maybe perhaps a little different than forgiveness. Right? But to remit it means that it's not going to... That comes back.
Wow.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've been so patient.